Right, I think we can start. Thanks everybody for coming to this seminar and presentation. This is not our usual venue. The seminar is part of a series of the research and policy seminars of the Hellenic Observatory. We usually have a smaller and less nice, I think, room. But today I think the importance of the topic, but also the seniority of our speakers justify a bigger room and with better lighting. The Hellenic Observatory organizes a series of seminars which run every second Tuesday. And before I forget, our next seminar is on Tuesday, the 22nd of November. We're looking again at Greece on outward migration from Greece during the crisis. Professor Lois Labrianides from the University of Macedonia will be presenting that. But I'm sure you're more interested in today's topic and speaker. Dimitris Vagianos, most of you perhaps know him, is a professor of finance, head of the department here at the London School of Economics, and he's also director of the Paul Woolley Center for the Study of Capital Market Dysfunctionality. He received his PhD in MIT, and he has taught in Stanford, MIT, before coming to LSE. He has many accolades. He's fellow of the British Academy, affiliated to the CEPR and the MBR, and he's managing editor of the Review of Economic Studies, among other things. He has published widely in leading economic journals and finance journals, like the Journal of Finance, Review of Economic Studies, Quarterly Journal of Economics, and others. And his research is mainly on obviously financial markets, asset prices, and liquidity in financial markets, although his work here today is more related to Greece and not only, I think, the financial, but the wider problems and issues that emerged with the Greek crisis since 2010. And he will present work related to a paper which is published by the Hellenic Observatory as a discussion working paper. And I think copies are available for everybody if you want to get a hard copy of this. His work together with colleagues on the analytics of the Greek crisis. We agreed that the Dimitris will run the presentation and you're free to ask questions during the presentation, but I'm mindful that we should allow also a bit of time towards the end for perhaps wider discussion. So if you want to pursue a point, feel free to interrupt and ask a question, but if that takes too long, I may ask you to continue the discussion towards the end of the seminar. Okay, without further ado, please join me in welcoming our speaker, Dimitris Vagianos.
Thanks a lot, Vasily, for the introduction. Okay, so this is a joint work with Pierre-Olivier Gouanchard at Berkeley and Thomas Philippon at NYU. Let me get the pointer. All right, so the paper is forthcoming actually in the NBR Macro Annual. So they asked us to write a paper on the Greek crisis, kind of with a macro perspective, and so this is what we have come up with. So let me kind of just give a general introduction. I know that some of you here know more about Greece. Some of you are more know more about economics or macro. So I will try to make sure that kind of to give enough background on both audiences. So just in terms of the sheer numbers, maybe I can just extend here. So Greece has experienced a kind of very dramatic economic contraction, we call it the Great Depression. So the in 2007, GDP per capita was around $35,000 in purchasing power parity, and unemployment rate was 8.4%, so not particularly low, but kind of on a reasonable side. And in 2014, GDP per capita had dropped to about $25,000 in PPP, and unemployment rate was more than a quarter. So this sounds like a dramatic movement. So the question is, how can we make sense of what happened? Okay, so we're going to do two main things in this paper. So the first part will be kind of an empirical, kind of what we call a benchmarking exercise. So we're going to compare Greece to other countries that experienced similar types of crises. So I would argue shortly that the crisis in Greece had different facets. There was an aspect that was a banking crisis, there was a sovereign debt crisis, and there was also what is called the sudden stop, there is a problem with external funding flowing into a country. So Greece experienced all three. So I would compare Greece to countries that experienced either one of these three types of crisis, as well as all three combined. And what we'll show in the paper is that actually Greece, even compared to that sample of countries, Greece was significantly worse, experienced a much more severe crisis. And even when it's compared to countries that what we call them strict payers, that essentially held, did not kind of devalue their currency or did not exit a currency union or a currency peg. So, okay, so that this would be the first part of what we do in the paper. The second part would be a model-based analysis. So, we're going to develop stylized in many ways, but very complicated in other ways, model of the Greek economy that will have kind of a role for different actors of the system, like banks and the firms and the households and the government, and run through this model a number of shocks the model will give us some guidance on understanding exactly what was the importance of each type of shock in driving the macroeconomic dynamics that Greece experienced. So, and also we're going to do what is called counterfactual exercises. We're going to say, for example, what would have happened if, for instance, Greece had come to the crisis with less leverage both on the public debt side and on the banking side or the private debt side. What would have happened if there was a banking union in the Eurozone, so that if the funding cost for Greek banks had not increased by as much? What would have happened if the Greek government had been more fiscally responsible in the years leading to the crisis? And by what would have happened, I mean by how much less GDP would have fallen, by how much less would investment have fallen. So, and finally, what would have happened if prices were more flexible? If prices would have adjusted, wages and prices would have adjusted more in response to this, to the shocks. So the model will give all of the answers to all these questions for free. I mean, kind of it will be easy to have them once we kind of estimate the model and we the model kind of will tell us how different shocks would work their way through the economy, and then we can shut down from the effects of some particular shocks or change some particular parameters of the economy. Okay, so I will spend maybe a bit more time on the latter part of the talk. Now, okay, what I was saying about the crisis that kind of Greece went through. So there were three types of crisis. It was a very complicated crisis. Maybe there was, I mean, one can argue even there was a problem with also kind of the Greece's institutions or political system or other things, but we're going to focus on the macro side. And from a macro point of view, there were three kind of distinct crises. This is how kind of the way kind of macro people would think about those. So first of all, there was a sovereign debt crisis. So debt was set on an unsustainable path, and there was actually a default. It took place as soon as the crisis erupted, but in 2012. This was the PSI. Then that was the first. The second aspect of the crisis was a banking crisis, so maybe a bit less kind of emphasized than the other, the sovereign aspect. So since euro entry, there was a boom to in credit to the private non-financial sector, so to firms and households. It was not such a big boom as in Ireland or in Spain, but still the growth of credit to the private sector to GDP was quite important. Actually, the growth rate in Greece from 1998-2008 was the highest among all the countries that experienced crisis in the Eurozone. Just Greece had started from a very low basis. Its credit to GDP did not increase as much as in Ireland or Spain, but the growth rate was the fastest. So, so what happened then? So then, there was a lot of increasing kind of credit. Then, when the recession hit, there were projected losses on all these loans. in addition with the fact that banks were hoarding Greek bond, sovereign bonds, so there was kind of the effects of the sovereign crisis, there was a massive hit to the solvency of Greek banks, and the banks were through multiple rounds of recapitalization resolution for some banks. So this was kind of an important facet of the crisis as well. And finally, and more broadly, and this is kind of an important part as well, there was a sudden stop. So what is it? So Greece was running persistent and large current account deficits. So it was it had to borrow a lot, both either through the government or through the private sector to finance the gap between its, roughly speaking, the gap between its imports and its exports. For some reason, I mean, with the advent of the global financial crisis, this flow of capital became much harder. So foreign investors were unwilling to finance Greece as a whole. The governments, leading to the sovereign debt crisis, the banks and the firms, and this related as well to the banking crisis. So this was quite an unexpected development to many observers. Somehow there was the belief that in a currency union this would not happen, and in particular that the ECB would step in massively and address any sudden stop problems. To some extent, the ECB did step in, but this and so the sudden stop was more kind of gentle for Greece than for a typical, let's say, emerging market economy. But still, nevertheless, it had consequences. All right. Obviously, as I said before, all three crises were linked. So, okay. So before I go into this kind of the whole exercise, just a bit on the literature. So, so we touch upon three strands of the literature. So there has been a big literature in international finance, international macro, about crisis, kind of defining sudden stops, looking at the effects of sudden stops on output. So then there is a literature. So anyway, so quite a bit of what we do in the empirical part of the paper, the benchmarking part, touches on that. There is a literature on DSG's dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model. So we're going to estimate one for Greece, and the kind of how to estimate this model. So we borrow quite a lot of the techniques in that literature. And anyway, finally, and then there are some formal analysis of the Eurozone and the Greek crisis, including by one of my co-authors on this paper, and we actually borrow quite a bit on the tools that they have developed in that paper. So, okay, so let's go now to the empirical exercise. Let's do the benchmarking of Greece to other countries that experienced crisis, a severe crisis. So, okay. So we're going to construct a comparison group. We're going to look at all other, I mean, kind of a large set of other countries since the 1980 that experienced various types of crisis. This set of countries we're going to look includes both advanced economies and emerging market economies. So for, so sudden stops. So here we follow conventions in the literature, standard conventions. So sudden stops, we define them as a combination of a reversal of capital flows. So a country that had been receiving capital, at some point capital flows stop or reverse, and if this is associated with a drop in domestic output, we call it a sudden stop. So there are 49 of these episodes. Sovereign defaults are defined in a very straightforward forward way. There has to be some default on domestic or external debt, and lending booms and busts. Lending booms are defined as, again, in the standard way, as a maximum, as a large enough deviation from of credit to out, the credit to GDP ratio, credit to output ratio from its trend. Okay, so this is the sample that we look at. So there are 49 sudden stop episodes, 36 in emerging market economies, 13 in advanced economies, 65 default sovereign default episodes, almost all of them in emerging market economies except for Greece, in an advanced economy. And again, the lending booms, 114, 18 are in advanced economies. And the trifecta episodes, trifecta is when essentially all three of those are combined. So a country experiences both a sudden stop and a sovereign default and a lending boom and bust. This is kind of a very nasty set of crises. So there are 10 in the sample. with Greece being the only advanced economy. So, okay, so now we'll show you some graphs where we're going to compare Greece to the path of various macro variables in Greece to that in other countries in the sample. Okay, so this is...
Going back to the previous slide, what's in the last column? Those numbers?
The numbers... Let me see. Let me make sure that I get this correct.
Countries.
Yes, this is just the number of countries. So, and this can be... Okay, so here can be more episodes than countries just because there are multiple episodes in one country. All right. So, okay, so here is GDP. So, real output per, as measured by real output per capita. And, okay, so we look at essentially the change relative to the 2 years before the crisis. So, so for Greece, we date the time T, the crisis time, in 2010. I know that's a bit arbitrary, but somehow this is when arguably the first financial assistance package was received by Greece. And, okay, so for the standard stocks, we follow the conventions that are used in the literature. As I said, that it has to be this output drop combined by reversal in capital flows. So what the main lesson from this figure is that the initial decline in Greece's GDP was not exceptionally severe. It was kind of, in some sense, normal. It was like, in the middle of this sample of countries. These are confidence intervals here, this gray, 95% confidence intervals. So, but what happens is that the Greek crisis kind of went on and on, and so it was very protracted and much deeper. So after the third year, the output per capita becomes kind of unusually low, and then this drop continues. So it was kind of deep and protracted relative to the comparison group. So then the other kind of very kind of dramatic aspect of the crisis was that this shows even more sharply in the investment to output. So this is the investment to output ratio. So so investment really dropped hugely during the crisis. So this is again, these are for the group of sudden stop countries for that sample. So again, there is also a drop in investment to output, which eventually recovers. So in Greece, investment to output continued to drop to kind of very low levels. Now, and this is, here's just the ratio of investment to output. Output also had kind of, as we saw in the previous picture, dropped unusually much. So somehow investment dropped hugely during the crisis. If we were to plot consumption to output, it's very much on the average of the southern stock countries. So it was really the main kind of the key part of the crisis was about the drop in investment. Now, we can also benchmark relative to other comparison groups. So this is so a bunch of colors here. So this is the line with the squares is the Ireland, Italy, Portugal, Spain, the IPS. So without Greece, and there was a drop in output per capita, but by far smaller than Greece's. Then here we have this blue line. Here is the trifecta episodes. Remember, the episodes where all three kind of types of crises are combined. Kind of Greece looks similar to a trifecta until year T, for the first 2 years after things start getting bad. But then trifecta countries recover and Greece kind of keeps going bad. And the Greek episode looks significantly worse than a sovereign default episode. Okay. Now,
Dimitri, sorry, can I interrupt? Because you said we can interrupt you.
Yeah, of course.
One explanation for this, and I don't know if you're going to talk about this later, is that the Greek case is particular on how the reaction, how the economy reacted, and it continued to decline. The other explanation is that you had a series of continuous political shocks that intensified the crisis and prolonged the crisis. So, both explanations are consistent with the graphs that you showed. So are you going to
tell us? So, fine. That's right. They are consistent. So, well, so far, so this is, for now, it's just purely descriptive. We don't even try to go into the mechanisms that could have generated things. Maybe also some of these other countries experience political shocks. We don't know. Here we can say we're not measuring anything like that. In the model, we're going to feed it data, but we're not, again, it will not be political data. We'll feed it various types of economic time series, and we're going to try to decompose these movements into different types of shocks. There will be, again, there will not be a political shock. I mean, this could be interesting kind of thing to perhaps to measure it in some way, but we don't do that. Perhaps the political shock would be manifested through maybe some of the other shocks. So, but yeah, but in the model part, we're going to try to get to the at least to a bit deeper into this curve. Yeah. All right. So, okay, so I go through the picture, then, okay, so here actually what we do is that we plot the full sample of trifecta crises. Here I just showed you the average. Here, this is the average of the trifecta countries, this blue here. This is the full sample. So, there is one episode that kind of looks almost as bad as Greece, which is Uruguay. In 83. Argentina in 2001 was kind of reasonably bad. But you can see here Greece is worse than all of them in the end. So, again, the initial drop was not as bad, but it was very protracted, a very protracted episode, yeah.
I mean, one factor that is missing from all the other crises is the fact that effectively Greece no longer has a currency. So effectively, you know, there has been no devaluation that usually helps when you have such a deep crisis. While in all other cases, you know, they had a currency devaluation.
Okay, so this we're going to address. Okay. That's something that we can at least, we have thought a bit about this and see what we can do. So we're going to, this nicely to the next, I think we have the next slide. So we're going to look at the dynamics of GDP for example, for the sudden stops by breaking down the sample into countries that had a floating currency, countries that were pegging their currency, and countries even that changed from a pegged currency to a floating currency in the middle of the crisis. So, and then we're going to do even something else further on. But let me just show you that first. So, these are the floaters, the green. And so you see that the floaters have had it easier than the strict peggers, which are the blue. So strict peggers are countries that just stuck to a peg for the whole time of the crisis. So yes, so somehow sticking with your currency has made it worse for these countries. I mean, perhaps there were other benefits, but so the. But again, Greece has had the more protracted decline. Even the strict peggers, in the end, they recovered. Now, we can further dig into that issue, and we can perhaps one can argue that the strict peggers somehow they did not depeg because they knew that it would be easier for them to withstand the crisis or to recover. It was endogenous kind of the decision whether to peg or not, to go to a floating currency, and somehow Greece would have massively benefited by going by leaving the euro, and for some reason it didn't do it. So what we do here, we just look at Estonia and Latvia, that also were in the euro, had recently adopted the euro, and for one can argue that it was very important for these countries to stay within the euro for other reasons than economic reasons, kind of just for the political benefits of being part of the eurozone. And so they just wanted to hang on, basically, despite the. And so, yeah, Estonia and Latvia, they went through worse crises. Kind of they had this 20% decline for Estonia of GDP in log point, GDP per capita. So, but again, they recovered. So, kind of the crisis was not as long-lasting, let's say, as in Greece, and eventually Greece's crisis was deeper. Let me just show you one last picture, and then we can summarize main lessons from all this exercise. So here is the trade balance to GDP. So export minus imports, and this is the, we measure it just to, whatever, for reasons that the international economics people like, to measure it relative to a deviation from country mean, as opposed to in absolute terms, so that to make things a bit more comparable, I guess, too. So so what we see here is that Greece's trade balance to GDP showed an improvement, and we know, in fact, that Greece went from a large trade deficit to a kind of almost like a balanced current account. So again, this deviation, this adjustment was quite gradual. So you see, for example, for the sudden stop episodes, most of the adjustment, that's the sudden stop is the kind of this line here. So for the typical sudden stop, the improvement occurs rapidly for the over the first 2 years, and then it kind of peters off. So for Greece, it was kind of a very gradual adjustment. And the other related piece of information is the real exchange rate, which is measured used as a measure of competitiveness. So the so the real exchange rate for Greece improved over time, but in much less dramatic ways than for example, let's say for other episodes, especially on the Tripartite crisis. So there was some improvement, but kind of very gradual. Okay, so
can I ask a question? How would IPS look in this plot?
I think it would look quite comparable, actually.
To
Greece.
To Greece.
Yeah, I think so. Let me think. Let me just make sure I don't say something stupid. Yeah, I think probably even I think it would look comparable. Perhaps I would dare say that might be even look less. The drop might have been smaller, but I mean, certainly what I know is that that wages in Greece dropped much more than in the other countries, and inflation and I mean goods market inflation was comparable to that in Greece.
So and their external, their trade balance was the dramatic as the shift was dramatic as for Portugal, Italy.
I think that no, because they didn't have such big Greece had the biggest trade deficit. So I think so. Manoli, you would probably know these numbers.
No, the trade balance adjustment was similar. So actually, the real exchange rate you use prices to calculate it. So prices dropped much more, especially in Ireland and Spain, and less in Greece. So I don't know if you use wages here. Wages dropped more in Greece, but prices dropped more in the other countries than in Greece, the other Eurozone countries.
Okay. So, all right, so maybe, okay, fine. So maybe I should go wrong. Anyway. I know, but, okay, for example, wait a minute. So Italy, for example, did not have any, current account problem, right? So then there was no adjustment. Essentially, it was very, very almost flat. So it was, okay, you're saying for the other countries. All right, so, yeah.
My kind of major reaction looking at the graphs would be that most other countries basically improve their trade balance because of the currency devaluation. While in the case of Greece, it was probably related to the weakness of domestic demand relative to external demand, which explains the gradual deterioration there and the gradual improvement there. Yeah.
I think
Greece
is a bit knee-jerk One difference that is there is today's target. You were not forced that quickly to stop. There's a cross-border payment system that replaces the foreign exchange constraint. And in that sense, in a way, it says you have more time to adjust gradually, and it is more persistent.
That's right, yeah. So that's right. So Greece had the way to adjust more gradually, yes, absolutely. Exactly. Because of the kind of safety mechanisms in the mechanisms in the Eurozone, it adjusts more gradually. Yes, I agree. So, fine. So, all right. Anyway, so let's summarize things. So, okay. Main lessons from the exercise. So, the Greek crisis was significantly more severe and persistent and backloaded than typical sudden stop. Same for trifecta episodes. Same compared to the pagers. Even when we use Estonia and Latvia, who arguably kind of wanted to peg for other reasons than economic reasons. And the unusual feature of the crisis was that the collapse of aggregate investment was very high, again, relative to the benchmark group. And the adjustment of external balances was very gradual. Okay, so, these are the conclusions from the benchmarking exercise. Now we're going to do some dirty DSG. So I will shield you from the gory details of some of the equations, but let me just kind of again say what the goal of the exercise here is. The goal of the exercise is to have a stylized but yet sufficiently rich model of the Greek economy, that in which we can have kind of the key players. So we're going to have the government, we're going to have banks, households, and firms. We're going to specify kind of natural ways through which all these players interact. And we're going to have a kind of some rough ideas about what are the parameters, the macro parameters that govern the relationships between all these players. Some of the parameters we're going even to estimate them in kind of using past data. And once we build this model, then we're going to use it to do interesting things. So it will be a bit of an investment to go through some of the details of the model, but the model can tell us interesting things about, for example, we saw this behavior of output of investment. It will tell us why output fell in this way. It was actually, it was a complicated set of phenomena that happened. So we'll try to parse them out. Say, some of the output was due to government expenditure fell. Some of the output drop was because there was the sudden stop. So we'll try to decompose it to different types of shocks. Now, this does not mean that this is the kind of the truth of God, the model or the shocks. Perhaps there were other shocks, like political shocks, and in the model they're going to manifest themselves through the types of shocks that we consider, if such shocks existed and were important. But anyway, so we're going to do this decomposition and I will show you some cool pictures that, for example, show how what part of the drop in GDP in which year was due to which type of shock, according to our kind of model. And then we're going to do these counterfactuals. We will say what happened if, for example, Greece had borrowed less in the markets. How much would it have been? Would the drop in GDP have been lower? Okay. So let me just try to give the basic features of the model. So we're going to have a government. So four players: government, household, firms, banks. So the government has some debt. So the government debt, we denote it by B, capital B, and there will be little b for the debt to GDP. That's right. So then B is debt, and the little b, will be like log, some kind of deviation of the debt from trend. Sorry. So anyway, so there will be debt of the government. So this is, for example, I will not go through all the equations, but just to give you an idea. For example, this is the government budget constraint that says that if the government spends more, G is how much the government spends, or makes more transfers, then it will have more debt in the next period. On the other hand, if it can raise taxes, and then it will have less debt. So this is the government's budget constraint. We'll assume a fiscal rule for the government that says that if the government, for example, has a lot of debt, then it cannot, because it follows this fiscal rule to keep its debt sustainable, then it it would have to cut down on its expenditure. So its expenditure G, again in log kind of deviations from trend, would have to be smaller when B goes up, or when the government's funding costs, which are R, go up. So they would have a fiscal rule that characterizes how the government spends based on how much debt it has and how much it costs to service it. And then we're going to assume, and this is kind of just an exogenous assumption, a funding cost for the government. So this is so we're going to call this RTG, that will depend on RT. So think of RT as the interest rate in the eurozone, kind of the kind of some kind of general level of the interest rate in the eurozone. And there is this DTG, which measures essentially the probability of that the government can default. And the probability that the government can default, so if the probability that the government can default is higher, the government will have to pay has to borrow at a higher interest rate. And the probability that the government defaults is higher if the government has more debt or output is lower. So what is quite key, what would be quite key here for the macro dynamics would be debt to income or debt to GDP ratios. If, for example, debt to GDP ratio is high, the funding costs of the government are going to be high. And we're going to have a similar kind of similar equation for the private sector. That so the rising funding costs as a function of the private sector's debt and income. So so that's the government. So it has this debt, it has the funding cost for the debt, and it has a rule that specifies how much it can spend based on its debt. So then we're going to have households. Okay, so government, households, firms, banks. So we're going to have households, and households, some of the households are going to be savers, they're going to be kind of more patient households, and some households are going to be more impatient, they're going to be borrowers. And what will happen in equilibrium is that the borrower households will accumulate some debt, and again, they will have some probability of default, and the probability of default will depend on the probability of default here will depend on how much debt they have, which is this B, and relative to what their income is. So let me not kind of, that's the summary about households. We just need to know that some households are borrowing and some are saving. Then we're going to have some non-financial firms, which for not reasons that have to do just with the kind of ease of working with the model, we're going to break them down into two types of firms: firms that produce capital and other firms that use capital to produce goods. And so firms, the aggregate of firms are going to be borrowing, are going to from the banks, and are going to be borrowing from the banks to use capital, and then they're going to be producing goods and selling them in the market. And finally, there are banks, but before going to the banks, we're going to assume kind of that there is some price and wage rigidity. This is what makes the model a new Keynesian model. So we're going to assume that prices, both prices and wages, are not perfectly flexible. So this is here, all these equations are kind of standard in the literature. They're called kind of Calvo equations that essentially say that prices and wages can adjust in a gradual way to, let's say, when there's unemployment, wages are going to drop gradually. And same thing when there is not, demand is low, prices are going to drop gradually. So this price and wage rigidity are quite key for demand to have an effect on output. So if for example, let's say government spending goes down because let's just anticipating what will happen later. If let's say there is a funding cost to the government, kind of the government has a bigger cost to service its debt, it will spend less, and then because it spends less, because of this price rigidity, the output is going to drop, and unemployment is going to rise. If the prices were not rigid, the effect on output would have been weaker, kind of or non-existent. If there was
I was told some more saving and some more borrowing.
Yes.
How is this the split?
So we have
general term.
Yeah, we have just a fixed.
It's a fixed mass.
It's a fixed mass.
You just assume it.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was. We just assume that some are impatient, some are patient.
Okay.
And then there is a borrowing limit on how much, there is this borrowing limit here, how much the impatient ones can borrow. And in the end,
and
the
patient ones, which is saved.
Yes, that's right. All right. Finally, there are banks. So banks borrow from the Eurozone and can also have domestic, can also have deposits domestically, and lend to can lend to the government, can lend to households and to the private sector, to households and to firms. So they have anyway. So again, we assume that they have some. This is their franchise value. This is essentially this is their equity value in equilibrium, and the, how much they can lend, which are these amounts B, depends on is some kind of fraction of their equity. So now, what's quite key is this last equation here that says that the costs that banks incur to fund households and firms depend on the probability of default of these agents. So if, for example, the income of households, the debt of households is high, sorry, if the debt of households is high relative to their income, then the funding costs are going to be high. All right. So,
what difference would it make if there were capital requirements for sovereign exposure?
Yeah, I could think about that.
Probably increased a devastating dynamic or in a crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that the dynamics would be more intense. That's right. Kind of this, I will describe in a minute this loop that we're going to have in the model. I think the loop would be more severe. That's right. Because, but anyway, the thing is that, okay, but I have to say, though, I'm not 100% sure, because the government can also borrow abroad. The banks really are the Greek banks are the only agents who can lend to Greek households and Greek firms. So, I don't think it's going to make big difference, but, so I think it's, anyway, I don't think it's a very important assumption but anyway. So, all right. So now let me just.
How do banks decide to whom to lend?
Well, okay. I think it's fairly. This is fairly simple because the return the. The returns are the same. So lending to
equilibrium.
Yes, the equilibrium are the same. So lending to households or to firms, this equilibrium has the same return. So this is just you can just think just aggregate basically. Yeah, here is okay. So now the okay. So now let me just so I set upward this machinery. Let me just describe the basic dynamics. So this has to do with doom loops. So kind of loops that go from the sovereign to the private sector and vice versa. Now in our model, okay, so there are some aspects of doom loops that we're not capturing in this model. So for example, if the sovereign gets into trouble, banks get hurt because they hold the sovereign bonds. So this we're not going to have in the paper. And in fact, so connecting to my previous my answer to your question, think of the sovereign as just borrowing from abroad. So banks also borrow from abroad to lend to the domestic households and firms. So so let's say now there is a sovereign risk shock. So what does sovereign risk shock do here? Actually, let me just go back to remind you some things. Here is a sovereign risk shock. So sovereign risk shock affects the perception of the probability that the government will default. And this increases the government's funding costs. Okay, so what happens if there is a sovereign risk shock? So this RT here, the government's funding costs go up. Therefore, by the fiscal rule, the government's going to spend less. Now, because the government spends less, and because we have this Keynesian structure in the model, we have price and wage rigidity, output is going to drop. And because output is going to drop, the what happened? I had to drop.
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't do this. Okay, fine. Okay, so let me just recommence with the effect of an increase in the government's funding costs. So, funding costs increase. The government reduces expenditure. Output drops because of this price rigidity. Now, what happens if when output drops? So there is debt in the private sector, but the output of the private sector goes down. So the default probability of the private sector is going to increase, and therefore the funding costs for the private sector are going to increase as well, and the investment is going to drop. So that's the one part of the loop. So increasing sovereign risk shock spills over to the private economy, and the investment is going to drop. So what happens instead when there is a sudden stop? So there is an increase in the funding cost of the private sector. So banks have a harder time funding themselves from abroad, Greek banks, and therefore they increase the cost of funding to Greek firms and households. So, okay. So output and investment drop. Just Greek firms now are going to have a higher cost of funding. They're not going to invest less. So output is going to drop, again, because of the price and the wage rigidity. Therefore, okay, so how is this going to hit the government in the model? Fiscal revenues are going to drop. So remember, taxes are proportional to output. So the expected loss, the cost of default on the sovereign is going to, the probability of default on the sovereign is going to increase, because the probability of default depends on debt relative to output for the sovereign, debt to GDP, and therefore the government's funding costs are going to increase as well. Now, anyway, so these are the two kind of key loops in the model. Now, of course, in reality, both shocks can happen at the same time. It's not that there is just one shock to the funding cost of the private sector and one shock to the cost of the government. But the model shows that even though the two shocks were unrelated, one would kind of bring about the other. All right. So anyway, I will show you some impulse response a bit later, and this mechanics will be quite important for understanding these impulse responses. So here we go. So let's say that here is okay, now let me see. Why do I show you all these tons of curves? So actually, let me just give a little bit of background on that. So okay, so now we have finished describing the basic structure of the model. Now, the economy is going to be hit by different types of shocks. So there will be shocks, kind of a sovereign default shock, sovereign risk shock, kind of increasing the perceived probability that the Greek government is going to default. There will be a sudden stop shock, then increasing in the funding cost for the Greek private sector. There could be shocks to prices, to wages. So in order to be able to separate how each type of shock, what was the contribution of each type of shock in driving the dynamics of the economy, we have to have a sense of how each type of shocks affects all the variables in the economy. And then we can look at the dynamics of all the variables in the economy, and then we can see, okay, maybe this year this shock was more important because the way the variables and the economic variables moved looked more like the kind of signature, so to speak, of this shock. It would have looked like how this shock had, it was, look, the dynamics looked more like the dynamics that are driven by this type of shock. Anyway, so then we can do this exercise. I mean, this is kind of standard kind of DSG analysis. So essentially look how different types of shocks affect the economy. So for example, this is a sovereign risk shock. And we show here that So when essentially this is an increase in the cost of default of the government, and so for example, we, through these doom loops that I described earlier, we see that this has an immediate effect on output, kind of to cause output to drop, and because government expenditure drops, and then investment drops, employment drops, so obviously the sovereign yield is going to go up. And anyway, so every type of shock that we have in the model is going to have kind of a signature in all these variables, that, in all this macro time series. And so anyway, so I will not walk you through all the series. So what we do then is, okay, so here these are all the shocks that we consider. And of course, the types of previous pictures that I showed you show describe how each shock affects all the variables. So let me just recall, kind of, just list kind of the shocks that we consider. So there is the sovereign risk shock that I described, kind of increasing in the government's perceived probability of default. There is the the funding cost shock. So for the private sector, for the funding cost of the private sector, we allow for a government spending shock. So the government kind of suddenly decides to spend more than what its fiscal rule allows it to spend. There is what other shocks are worth mentioning? There is a shock that increases the default rates of loans in the private sector. We call it a private default shock. There is okay. Anyway, enough for now, and I will show you them in a picture. You will see once we have a picture, it will be kind of. I can talk to you through these shocks more easily. So anyway, and then we're going to estimate a massive number of parameters for this for the model. So a number of parameters, we just calibrate them based on what macro people use for their kind of similar models. For example, the discount factor, the coefficient of risk aversion, elasticity of substitution across goods, wage stickiness, others. So and some parameters we estimate, a few parameters we estimate from the past data. So anyway, so and then we fit to the model this 8 series. So we have 8 shocks, and we're going to fit to the model 8 series, and then we're going to essentially it's like solving a system of 8 equations with 8 unknowns. For every kind of the 8 series in a given year will tell us what 8 shocks hit that year, and then we'll do this exercise again in the next year, etc. So,
These are observed.
These are observed, yes.
So effectively what you're doing is almost like a perfect foresight test. So you're running it through the system with realized data.
That's right, with realized data, of course. That's right. Exactly. That's right. We're saying, given that the dynamics turned out to be this way, which shocks generate these dynamics? Now we're also going to do some other exercise that we're going to see, to say how does well... Once we have these shocks here, how well does the model match series that we did not use to do this exercise? And actually, it does match them reasonably well. So, maybe a few comments on this series. So this is government revenue. So is not revenue to GDP, just revenue. So revenue went up. But also GDP was going up quite a lot before the crisis. Then it went down a lot, again with GDP going down. Government spending went up significantly more than revenue, as you can see here, and significantly down during the crisis. This is the yield on the government debt. It went up a lot. Here is when the default occurred. Then it went down after the default occurred. And anyway, so this is the private funding cost. This is so you see that it went up quite a bit from 2010 onwards. These are the non-performing loans. They went up quite a bit once the crisis occurred. This is the GDP deflator. So the change in the GDP. Okay, so change in the GDP deflator. So
All right, so this is... okay. Yeah, so...
Inflation.
Yeah, deflation. I'm just trying to make sure that I get this right when it started. But anyway, so yes. So, yeah, at some point, yeah, obviously deflation starts occurring. And okay, anyway, so here's the, there's wage inflation. Again, wage inflation goes down. So, all right. Now, okay, fine. So here we estimate the shocks. Here, anyway, so these are kind of how each shock looks, but I will show you kind of nicer picture, so let me not spend much time on those. So this is how the model fits. So here is, for example, output, and for output we did not use the model to tell us what we do not use output to back out the shocks. So this is what the model says should have happened to output given the shocks and given all the parameters we have calibrated. And this is what actually happened to output. So the model is not that far off, even for a situation we have not used to back out the shocks. Same roughly for investment. Okay, for inflation is less good. For price inflation, for wage inflation is very good. So, okay. And for current account, reasonably. Okay, so now this is the kind of the pictures that I want to emphasize the most that I was trying to advertise earlier. So so look especially at this picture here on GDP. So this is GDP, kind of, again, this is GDP relative to a trend. Okay, so there are some what's called filters that are used to extract whatever, what's a trend component of GDP and what is the deviation from the trend. So this is the deviation from the trend. So you see that, so GDP, okay, actual GDP is the black curve. You see that GDP went up a lot from until 2007 is the highest value for GDP. Then it started, and okay, obviously then it went down a lot. So what happened? Now let's look a bit at the shocks. So GDP had, okay, so GDP started going up mainly because of the red shock. So you see the contribution of the red shock to GDP growth is kind of parallels the path of GDP until 2007, 2008. And this is government spend. So the model says that much of the growth until 2008 was driven by government spending. Okay. Then GDP started going down, especially, okay, in 2009. What happened in 2009? So government spending was equally high as in 2008. But the one key negative shock was the green one, which was the sudden stop. So the sudden stop, okay, so means funding costs started going up for the Greek private sector. And also showed here in the behavior of investment. So investment went down, GDP went down. Then, in 2010 and 2011, what happens here is that also the government spending shock elite is gone. So now government has to cut its spending. Essentially, what the model says that it was overspending relative to the fiscal rule, relative to how much it could spend relative to its debt. And it's the funding cost of its debt, etc., and its GDP. It was overspending. This is why these shocks are kind of positive. So now in 2010, it went to to what the fiscal rule would say that it would be doing. It should be doing. So there was a big cut in spending. This drove a big cut in GDP. A big drop in GDP.
Sorry.
Yes.
Spending infrastructure or is it pensions? What is the spending?
Spending is in our data is everything together. All of government spending. So it's a actually, let me just make sure that I get this right.
What was the increase on?
Let me just make sure that I get this right. First of all, it's total spending. In any case, most of the spending is, spending in infrastructure, this is public investment, is small. It's maybe, I don't know, one-tenth or total spending or something. It's not a... Most of the spending is pensions, salaries, public procurement, kind of these things. So this essentially the drop here is on these items.
Private spending is not in there because this should
be private spending.
Yes.
No, private spending is not. No, private spending is not in there. I guess what your point is, that is that output dropped also because private spending dropped. This is what you're saying. Yeah. No. No. Okay. Again, here we're looking. Private spending dropped, but the idea is that we look at the at some primitive types of shocks. So the primitive shocks are the ones that we have here. Kind of, we view shock to government spending as a primitive shock. It caused a drop also in private spending, but we are trying to decompose the drop in output to these kind of primitive shocks. Okay, so
finish the presentation in the next 10 minutes.
Yes, no problem. No worries. I will spend a bit of more time on this picture, and then I will show you the counterfactuals, and then we'll be done. So, so remember that for some of the counterfactuals I will show you later. So a big part of the drop from peak to trough was because of the drop in the red bar. So about half of the drop in GDP was due to the contribution of the red shock. Now, there was a contribution of the sudden stop shock, so the increase in funding cost to the private sector, so the green. And then what the picture shows, kind of in a tentative manner for 2014 and 2015, is that here the red output remains low, a bit higher than in 2013 in detrended terms. The red shock and the green shock have subsided. So what has taken over here is more let's call it turquoise shock. This shock here, which is private default, and the shock here on markups. So what this is telling us, if we take this decomposition seriously, is that the problems that are kind of impeding recovery now are not the the ones that were coming from abroad, like the about kind of the sudden, for example, the sudden stop, but are the problems about resolving the NPLs, the non-performing loans, which kind of cause high interest costs for firms, and also the fact that prices prices in product markets, in goods markets, are failing to adjust. So these are now more domestic problems that are impeding recovery. So that this is what is suggested by this, if we take this seriously. So now we can produce the same kind of curves for the decompositions for investment, for debt, etc. Let me not spend much time on that, and let me go to
So in the previous one, actually,
you want what, the previous curve?
Yeah, when the sudden risk disappears, maybe when the ECB starts the ELA with the emergency liquidity assistance, then that's when it stops, and then because they
so which one, the sovereign risk? You mean
the third? Yeah,
this one here.
Not the next one. You know that the sovereign risk basically
goes here.
Anymore.
So what happened here? Okay, well, I can tell you what happened here. Here was the PSI. So there was in 2012 there was the default on the debt, and then the spreads went down. Actually, as we see that actually quite nicely in the, let's see here. You see government yield very high in 2012, went down quite a bit in 2013 and onwards. Well, this was in anticipation of the default, obviously. Yeah. So, all right. Anyway, we call this the murder on the Orient Express because, in the sense that there were many factors that were responsible. Like in the Orient Express, it was a crime, and there were all these suspects, and every one of them had contributed in some way to the murder. So we say, kind of in the same way, there were many factors that contributed to the murder of the Greek economy. So. So fiscal trajectory clearly was unsustainable, and going to a sustainable kind of expenditure caused about half of the output drop, but there were other things as well. There was a sudden stop, which accounted for more than half of the rest. And now there are kind of these factors that I mentioned, the more kind of domestic factors, the non-performing loans and the markups in goods market that seem to be playing a role. So, okay, finally, let me tell you a bit about these counterfactual exercises. So what we can do, okay, so we can take the model and we can, well, now we have this machinery that kind of we use to describe the dynamics of the economy, and we say, suppose now that the economy went through the same, maybe through the same types of shocks, but with different parameters. For example, let's say that it went through the same types of shocks, but with a lower leverage. Let's say, like leverage that is more typical to that in emerging market economies. And I will show you some numbers to get that you get a sense of that. Or, for example, let's say that we were in a banking union, so there were no sudden stop shocks. There were no green shocks. What would have happened? Or the government had a more responsible fiscal path. Or the parameters that characterized price rigidity were smaller, so the adjustment of price and wages could have been faster. So, all right. So let's first of all do the leverage one. Okay, so here an interesting observation is that, so here we plot some parameters, some macro kind of measures of leverage. So one of them is credit to GDP, so credit in the private sector to GDP. So in Greece, it was about 100% of GDP. In a typical emerging market economy, it was about half. So sovereign debt to GDP in was 138. So this is... Anyway, so that is an average over, so 138. So in typical emerging market economies, significantly smaller. And similar kind of observation with the current account to GDP. So Greece could have a much larger current account deficit than a typical emerging market economy. So we're going to ask now what would have happened if all these parameters for Greece were half of their values that we put in the model. Well, how would the macro dynamics would have been? So, but before I do this exercise, and obviously we're going to find that drop in GDP would have been significantly smaller, essentially, Greece was able to have this much bigger leverage because it was viewed as an advanced economy, and it was used as part of the Eurozone, and it could borrow much more. So the question is how kind of... But at the same time, Greece experienced a sudden stop that is like a sudden stop of an emerging market economy. So how would a sudden stop manifest itself in an economy that has much more leverage than an emerging market economy? How would an emerging market disease manifest itself in an advanced economy? So, so that's about leverage. So this is... the blue is the data, and the yellow is what the model says has happened. So because we don't match our model, for GDP, for example, our model does not match the data perfectly. We don't use GDP as one of the variables to estimate the shocks. And the red is what the counterfactual would say. So if Greece was constrained to have half of its leverage, including debt to GDP, its output would not have been as high in the boom phase, but would also not, would not have dropped as much in the bust phase. And the numbers, roughly, output would have been about 10% higher than what it ended up being. So investment would have actually been substantially higher. So 20% higher or so. So So lower leverage would have helped. If there was a banking union in the Eurozone, in the sense that funding costs had not gone up, then this also would have caused the output not to drop by as much, about 5% less or so. And so for investment, although the effect of leverage would have been more substantial. Then, okay, what would have happened if the Greek government had followed a more, let's say, responsible fiscal policy, in particular, we set all the fiscal shocks to zero. So then GDP, obviously, and expectedly, given the picture that I showed, the decomposition I showed you earlier, would not have increased by near as much as it increased before the crisis. And at the same time, it would not have dropped. Of course, the drop would have been smaller and would have been higher relative to what it is now. But not much higher, though. Just that it would not have been, essentially, government spending inflated the economy massively from the red to the blue and caused the drop to be much larger.
This assumes that somehow the crisis would have happened even if Greece was fiscally prudent.
That's right. Yes, good point. So we assume that, that's right, we assume that there would have been, for example, the sudden stop shock. Yeah. That's right. So still, I mean, there would have been the global financial crisis that could have affected the cost of financing for Greek firms. It's true that I think that's right. We're assuming also that there could have been still the shock of the kind of government funding costs also would have increased. And you're saying perhaps they wouldn't have increased as much. That's your point.
Well, if they hadn't announced a 12% deficit in 2009, I think.
So perhaps this is even an underestimate of how much kind of maybe things would have been even better than kind of if there was more fiscal prudence. And finally, let me show you one more picture, which is that what would have happened if price stickiness, if price stickiness would have been lower. So we set these price stickiness parameters to about half of their values in our exercise. So as you can see, the economy would have adjusted much faster. So output would have been higher by about 15%, and investment by to about 25%. If prices had adjusted more, especially in the goods market, the model says that the kind of things would have been the recession would have been significantly less severe. So, all right, so that's it. So here I just summarize the conclusions from these counterfactual exercises. So essentially you see that there were many factors that contributed to the drop in GDP, and kind of having a different environment would have alleviated the drop in GDP in kind of different ways. So the model is just a model, so there are things that are not in the model. And in particular, something that was particular seemed to be quite important for understanding the macro dynamics was the uncertainty about Eurozone exit. That was a key factor that anecdotally seemed to have discouraged investment and to account for the very big drop in investment. So that's not in the model. We don't have an uncertainty parameter about Euro exit. So certainly the uncertainty about Euro exit is manifesting itself through some other shocks, perhaps in a way that, it would be nicer to have some uncertainty shock like that. We have not looked within the model at the devaluation question, kind of just what would have happened if Greece had adopted its own currency early on. Of course, there are many more complicated things than just what is in the model about what would have happened with the Euro exit, kind of redenomination of contracts, lots of complicated things. Or what have happened if sovereign default had occurred earlier and government funding costs would have gone down earlier. So this we don't look. So anyway, we view it as a kind of, in principle, one can take this model and, change it in different ways and perhaps understand better dynamics in the past, perhaps with a richer structure, or even use it more to do policy exercises about the future. For example, a very big debate right now in Greece is about fiscal policy. Should taxes be, taxes are viewed as being very high, and should taxes be cut, and what would the effect on the GDP would be by cutting taxes by how much,
what would happen if expenditure is cut at the same time. Of course, cutting expenditure would also have some effect on GDP, kind of could reduce demand, but which kind of how these effects would play out. One can do these kinds of exercises, how this would interact with NPLs. There is a model that one can do many exercises with. So, okay, let me stop here and...
Great, thanks, Dimitri. Material to pick up on and a lot of to digest, I guess. So I repeat that a hard copy of this paper has been published by the Hellenic Observatory before the MBER published it. but we can take some time now for questions. Maybe you want to ask something more specific on the presentation or the implications of some of the things that were discussed. Maybe I'll collect a couple of questions depending on the number of hands I see. Huh?
Yes,
but I'll take yours first.
Why did you model the sudden stop as just a rise in funding liquidity, in funding costs? That seems to me to get exactly not at what could explain the difference. I mean, I think your paper is amazing. I've never seen anything that brings so many things together in a rigorous way. But I was wondering why you call it sudden stop. A sudden stop is like Halvor was a reversal of capital inflows. And that creates for trade finance immediately a constraint, a quantitative constraint. Of course, then funding costs go up, but that could explain why their drop is so deep and then jumps back like a V-shaped recession, while we have here this kind of much slower and then down and down and down because it allows you to finance the imports still, which shows you the two sides of target and the real difference between a fixed exchange rate system and a monetary union, going back to Lorenzo's earlier question. So for adjustment, there is a question, what would be better? But the difference is not really captured in your opinion.
Yeah, okay, fine. Look, I'm happy to concede that point. In other words, we called it sudden stop just because it had the flavor of the flow of foreign capital becoming more difficult. Mm. So, of course, it's not that the flow of foreign capital stopped. In fact, the flow of private capital stopped, and ECB support came in. Okay, this is essentially what happened. Yeah. But there was not a stop like that because of the ECB. Okay, so but we just want to capture the idea that somehow. It became harder for Greece to fund its economy, to fund its current account deficit, its current account deficit. If it were not part of a monetary union, things would have been much more violent, as you point out. So this made it more protracted. But anyway, we would have been happy to give a different name. It's just that it's just of the analogy. We're just so.
See a sudden stop happens just like everywhere, but you could not even devalue. Then one has to say, well, actually, you have time to adjust in a way.
Yeah.
And it is a difference whether you have a sudden stop inside the monetary union or outside.
Yes, 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 of course. I think this is very much what the data shows. I think this is what you pointed out, which is that the dynamics of Greece kind of were very different. Of course, unfortunately, it kept going down and down and down,
yeah.
But for other reasons too. This has to do with the fiscal expansion, and it was not just because of the sudden stop, and the other parameters, the price rigidity, etc. But yes, we see that it was much more gradual for precisely these very reasons. Anyway, I'm happy to it's not this kind of, it's a gradual stop. You should not call it a sudden stop. Yes.
Sorry, we have the same managers or governors, and they are not to be trusted. So how people can give money to people who cannot trust? It's a very serious. But do we have also? You should have also an objective mechanism where they see the development of the industries over the years. I don't know if we have that.
Sorry, I don't understand the question at all. So
the question is where is the question? It's like the interest of the national interest of Greece to get out of the European Union. like supervisors, and they also not skip that they don't go well. That means that the managerial governance system, whatever you call it, has failed. We have the same with the same people, which are they're duping. There's so many controversial rumors about what they're happening. So and where the funding of the industries taking over the years have been taken. So all these funds have been lost. So if you don't have, for example, I don't know, I'm just thinking a solution to lay out an objective mechanism where he takes the industries and over the years instead of being victims to politicians who are on the known
circles.
So technocracy versus corruption.
I see. Okay, yeah. Anyway, I mean, of course, these are very important issues. I mean, how to...
What do you see? I mean, there's like a huge collapse is visible from your... Where do you see
this
in the next few years?
Well, okay, this goes kind of beyond the scope of this project. I mean, I think that, of course, we can use this model for forecasting, and actually we tried to do a bit of that. So we found that there would be a fairly slow recovery. I should have brought these pictures to show you. I'm sorry, I haven't here. But anyway, because I think that let me just say what the model says. Essentially, let me just not go much outside the model. The model says that it would still kind of the time at which all these kind of shocks revert, like the NPL, the NPLs take time to be resolved. The price rigidities kind of take time. The price take time to adjust. So it says that output is going to grow quite slowly for the next 5 years or so. So, anyway, fine. How can I say? Anyway, one has to, even if one gets out of this model and kind of has a more general discussion, it seems that the kind of slow growth seems to be quite of a concern. I mean, that the recovery from the crisis is going to be quite slow because first of all, at current policies about taxation and all these things, but even if one looks at long kind of determinants of long run growth, which are, Greece scored fairly poorly, so it has to be like big changes in the country for there to be more growth. But maybe that's a bigger discussion, so let's leave it outside. I'm happy just to tell you what the model says. Yeah.
In terms of the counterfactuals, you said that you halved the three parameters. Did you try a model structure whereby you took the average of the emerging market economies to see, as a robustness check, what the average?
Oh, I see. So to run the counterfactuals in the emerging market economies, no, this we have not done. But we,
I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it would be equally, because you kept mentioning the fact that you're trying to almost simulate an emerging market scenario in an advanced economy. And I'm just saying,
here it is. But,
yes.
But yeah, that's right. Exactly. So this is the emerging market scenario for Greece. So that's.
Yeah.
But we have not done this for emerging market economies. We want to see We did the benchmarking exercise, right? So we used.
I don't think we are. No, I'm not talking about this. I'm just saying that if you go back to some parameters that you've.
These ones.
Where you say the typical EME, I'm referring to maybe putting these.
This.
Rather than
half.
The half.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. That's right. Good point.
Would really simulate the energy
market. Okay. Understood. Yes. Okay. Fine. Yeah. So it would have been probably a bit better than this. Yeah. A bit better than. Yeah.
I'm just trying to find a good scenario where everything goes up above zero, faster.
But okay. But now there is the leverage there. So the question is.
Yes.
So this we cannot magically erase it. Yeah.
If you could go to the picture with the, when you decompose the value shocks. So if I understand, the efficient thing for the economy to be is to be flat at zero, right? So these are deviations from, I guess, potential output or something like that?
These are deviations, yes. Well, actually, deviations, you feed a trend in output,
and you so and you measure from the trend.
Okay, so I'm wondering exactly then how you pick the trend, because then in 2010, when you had the very big drop in GDP, you've basically uptrend.
Yes.
Right, and I mean, so how did you pick the trend?
Yes, I think these are kind of macro things that anyway, so essentially, yeah, you put called the Hodrick-Prescott filter. So you use the output series, and then you essentially take some kind of average of the you feed a trend, but to that filter. So essentially, it says that output in 2010 was at zero, because here kind of it's like an average of this and that. The average of this and that roughly has to be zero.
The reason why I ask this is that, right, so the HP filter is somewhat sensitive to the endpoints, and here it seems to be that, you know, the trend is actually quite low, and the reason why this is important for policy is that, you know, it basically says that the upside right now for Greece is rather limited. So this is why...
Yeah, so you can say, fine.
For example, in your graph here for 2010 and 2011, despite the fact that there was a lot of austerity at the time and declines in public expenditures, still it seems that public expenditures has a positive effect on GDP, despite the, you know, for 2010 and 11, like the red ones.
Yeah.
I was sort of puzzling about that before, so
I
guess this is because the trend is very low, so even though you had a large decline in public spending, there's still, as a residual, it sort of pushes GDP up.
Yes.
Despite the fact that, you know, in 2010, public expenditure declined by 5 percentage points of GDP.
Yeah, but
it's massive.
The model says that still this was higher relative to,
right,
to,
exactly.
to what should have, it should have been given the fiscal rule and the...
Right, which means that the trend is very low.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. Well, that's right, yeah. But that's right, exactly. Yeah, so the model will interpret this high GDP as kind of unusually kind of too high. For Greece. Yeah, coming back to kind of just repeating your... Perhaps, yeah, anyway,
that's... Okay, I'm afraid we have run out of time. You can follow up other questions
up.
With Dimitris. I'm sure he will be happy to answer after the seminar by email, perhaps. Please join me in thanking Dimitris again for his presentation.